Hi everybody, it's 1 o'clock on Monday, and it's time for Pirkei Avot Halacha, History and Hashkafa. This week we're going to take a break from Pirkei Avot. We'll certainly have plenty to say after Pesach, but in the meantime, and we'll meet during Chol HaMoed too, please God. I want to take a break to discuss the Haggadah. It seems to be the thing to do. It certainly is the thing that's appropriate as we run to Pesach. And I want to give you some ideas and some insights as to how you might enrich your, your Seder. So first of all, something about the Haggadah. If you had to ask, I think me or anybody, what's the most important line in the Haggadah, I think people would probably tell you the four questions, or they would come up with all kinds of different possibilities, the matzah, the maror, whatever. But I don't think so. I think the most important line in the Haggadah is a line that I don't think we pay enough attention to as the run-up is to the meal, because especially this year we're going to be hungry, because those of us who are observant are not going to be able to start the Seder until late, because both in Israel and in the United States, at least, they will have already changed the clocks. Israel changes its clocks on Thursday. The United States already did last week. So the Seder, which can only start at nightfall, when the stars come out, which is about half hour, 40 minutes after sunset, that's a long Saturday afternoon to wait to eat, in any event, at least a meal. In any event, the people have a tendency as they go through the Haggadah to get a little antsy, and they once you take out the drops of wine from the cup for the 10 plagues, it's sort of like downhill to the meal. In any event, second half of the Magid, of the telling section of the Haggadah, there's one line. And the line is, "Bechol dor v'dor chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzah mimitzrayim." In every generation, everybody has to look at themselves as if they went out of Egypt. Now, it's interesting, the better reading, and probably the more authentic reading, is that of the Sephardic Haggadot, of the Mizrahi Haggadot, the non-Ashkenazi Haggadot. It's "Bechol dor v'dor chayav adam leharot et atzmo." One should demonstrate that one went out of Egypt. And as a result, you have all kinds of beautiful minhagim. These cross community boundaries, where at some parts of the Seder, you actually act out in some way or shape the fact that I see myself now as going out of Egypt. So, for example, there is an old Hungarian and Galician Polish custom that sometime during the Seder, the leader of the Seder takes matzah, puts it in a napkin, throws it over his shoulder, and leads the family around the table. And the custom is Eastern European, so the original they originally said this in Yiddish, "Fun vu kumstu fun Mitzrayim," where are you coming from? I'm coming from Egypt. "Vo in geistu kan Yerushalayim," where are you going? I'm going towards Jerusalem. You can translate that as you wish into whatever language you wish. But that's the idea. You're actually acting out. There's a famous Kafkazi Jewish custom that you actually do the Seder with your walking boots and your overcoat, because you're ready to go. We're leaving Egypt today. That's Laharot. But either way, however you want to, whatever the reading is of the text, the deeper meaning of that statement really underlies the entire Haggadah. And that is that we are, on Seder night, we are bidden to do, through studying and discussing the Haggadah and cracking the Haggadah, because the Haggadah is coded. It's not an easy text. If you want to really just have the story, you could just take down a chumash and read the Book of Exodus. And if you're not observant, you could screen Prince of Egypt or the Ten Commandments or whatever it is. If I remember correctly, E.M. Lowe, who was the owner of many, many movie theaters throughout the United States in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, he actually lived in Boston. And a friend of mine told me that he had a private theater, and that immediately afterward, during the Seder, they would screen a movie. So you could screen, the Ten Commandments, whatever the case might be, if you're not observant and using electricity isn't an issue. In any case, but so the issue is not knowing the story. The issue is understanding the story and turning it into an experience. What do I mean by an experience? Carol says that there's a Moroccan tradition similar to the Haredi one. I'm sure. It's not necessarily Haredi, it's Hungarian. But yeah, yeah, I'm sure there is. In any event, the point here is that in studying the Haggadah, we are bidden to do two things. One, to try to identify with the experience of our ancestors. Because Judaism has no sense of past. Now, it's going to sound bizarre, right? I don't mean that we don't have a sense of past, in the sense we have no historical memory. We have an overactive historical memory. What I mean is that in contemporary society, the past is usually referred to as dead, as the rabbis would say, "Ma'ida hava hava," whatever happened happened, and that's the reason why you can be an historian, or you can be an archaeologist, because archaeology is sort of the pathology of the past. It's dead. It's over there. The Jewish sense of past is of a living past. It's something that happened to us, and we identify with it 100%. So, as a result, we act it out because it happened literally to us. Now, that requires work on the inside, on our awareness, because we have to try to get past our own prejudices and our own experiences to try to see what it might have been like if we had actually been the ones going out of Egypt. But there's this time warp which lives in us, where the past is really alive. I know it's often said, and it's worth repeating, that when we quote rabbis, when we quote past authorities, we talk about them in the present tense. We say the Rambam says and Rabbi Akiva says and this one said, they're dead for thousands of years, ma. But we treat them as if they were still alive because they're so vivid for us. I learned this lesson actually from a bunch of older Jerusalem women. The first time I went to the Rachel's Kever, Rachel's tomb outside of Bethlehem, which is 50 years ago, there were a bunch of Yerushalmi ladies who were talking to Mama Rachel. They were talking to Rachel Imenu, to our mother, the matriarch Rachel, and pouring out the heart star like she was the next door neighbor. And I realized that the past is really vivid and accessible to us, and in fact, it vivifies us. So that's part of the obligation. What does it mean to us? What would we experience if we went out of Egypt? And then appreciate what we have. So that's one side of that, is if we went out of Egypt. There is, at the same time, very much an awareness that we didn't go to Egypt. And that we bring our own history, our own concerns, our own ideas, our own feelings to the act of understanding what does slavery mean, what did the Exodus mean, what did God punishing the Egyptians mean, what did God's salvation mean, what does it mean to be the chosen people, all these things. We bring to it who we are. So part of the job is to get out of ourselves, and part of the job is to bring ourselves to the task. And every generation, therefore, b'chol dor v'dor, experiences and understands the Haggadah differently against the background of their own experience and their own lives. Happily, to the thing, that means that's it's appropriate for Pesach, it's very liberating. It's liberating in the sense that it means that there's not necessarily any one right answer to any of the questions that I've just mentioned, and all the more that there are, because the Haggadah raises more questions than there are answers. But it gives us another opportunity to do something really, really exciting. The Haggadah is the single, after the Chumash, I think, the single most commented on book in the Jewish library. It's really striking. There are literally, people have collections of hundreds and thousands of Haggadot. People write in every generation, in every place across the globe. The diaspora reached from China to America, and from Archangel to South Africa. Everywhere people are writing commentaries on the Haggadah, because the Haggadah touches the deepest of our deepest feelings and our deepest ideas, and our deepest questions of identity. This is the Seder is a birthday party for the birth of the Jewish people and for the ratification of the covenant between Israel and God. This is stage one. Stage two will be Shavuot, when the Torah is given us, the Constitution. The so because and that's number one. Number two, the Haggadah. This I think I can say without hesitation is the most illustrated book in the Jewish library. The most, more than the Megillah, more than all kinds of other things. There are more illustrations and more illuminations of the Haggadah than anything else. Now, why this is a matter for the art historians, and it's not for right now. But what the result of both, but when people illustrate, when they illuminate a text, they also bring themselves. Oh, that's what artists do. They bring themselves to their topic, and they will portray what the text says in terms that they. In terms that they best understand and best identify, meaning they were usually a picture of what is going on inside them, and if they're part of a community, what is of concern to the community. As a result of both of these, by looking at the illuminations in the Haggadahs, and here I really urge you to have, since the text is pretty standard, right? I urge you to collect as many different types of Haggadahs as possible, with as many different types of illustrations as possible, because what that allows you to do is what I'm about to tell you, and that is to be able to not only go back in time and figure out how did our ancestors going out of Egypt feel and how did they experience the Exodus, but also how generations upon generations of Jews in different places saw the exact same text and related to them differently, which gives us an opportunity to be able to really enter into the experience of other ancestors in other places and see, wow, how did they experience it? And that opens up vistas. Unexpected vistas of what of experience and insight that we can then use. I'd like to give you a couple of examples, and a lot of these things are certainly they're available in Hebrew. Certainly there are translations of the classic many of the classic commentaries on the Haggadah that are translated into English. They've been translated to French, so it's not as if that there's no dearth. There's no dearth. But let me give you an example of what I mean. One of the and in the time that we have, we don't have a lot of time. But if you want recommendations, please, as always, you know, contact me offline. So let's start with one of my favorite examples of this. 1492, under the edict of Don Fernando and Doña Isabella. The king of Aragon and queen of Castile, respectively, the Jews were expelled from Spain. Now, the Jews had come to Spain at the latest in Roman times, and very possibly earlier. The edict of expulsion was taken on March 31st, 1492. The Jews were given a number of months to leave, and up and out. Now, when you consider the fact you're talking that Jews have been in Rome, in Spain over 1,600 years, the trauma of the expulsion from Spain is one of the great traumas of Jewish history. We have a lot, happily, we have a lot of diaries and discussions of the significance and the events around the destruction, the expulsion. But one of the most poignant was penned by one of the most dominant and prominent and preeminent representatives of the generation of the expulsion, Don Yitzhak Abravanel, who had been the treasurer, the minister of the treasury of the United Kingdom of Aragon and Castile. He wrote it in 1497, or he published it in 1497, within 5 years after he was expelled and lost everything. The book touched the soul of his generation, and it has never gone out of print ever since. It's called Zevach Pesach, the Pesach offering. In typical fashion, Abravanel, he has a certain specific type of style. He likes to line up 3 million questions on any issue, and then as he goes through his commentary, this is true of all of his commentaries in the Bible and other things, he answers the question. If you take a look at his commentary, the 10th question he asks relates to the beginning of the text of the Haggadah. The beginning of the text of the Haggadah says, "Vafilu anu vanenu veilu lo atzia kadosh baruch hu otanu mimitzrayim harei anu vanenu vnei vanenu b'shibushu abadim hayinu lefaro b'mitzrayim." If God had not taken us out of the land of Egypt, then we and our children and our children's children would have still been slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. Says Abrava now, Mahir vachnu, what did we gain? Anshei hagalut kamonu, exiles like us, hayom, b'meshi yatzu avotenu b'mitzrayim. In that, as regard, in regard, because it says with regard to our, that God took us out of Egypt, because of, and because it says that we would have still been slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt. He says, "Ki efshar shahayino yoshvim sham." Maybe it's possible we would have had a life wouldn't have been so bad. We might have lived there b'shalva, in peace and composure. Yoter mishivatenu begalut edom Yishmael. Maybe our life there would have been better than the exiles that we have among the Edomites and the Ishmaelites, meaning among the Christians and the Muslims. Ukimosham ru avotenu. And as our ancestors, the ones who complained to Moses for taking us out of Egypt, right? Kemosham ruah votenu halotov lanu avodat Mitzrayim mimutenu. Wouldn't it be better for us to have served the Egyptians than die in the desert? And then he adds, that's the verse. But then he adds, wouldn't it have been better if we serve Egypt than we should die in the desert and the wilderness of the nations? Among the forced conversions to other religions and the expulsions, and some go, though the, he who is destined, fated to the sword, goes to the sword. He is fated to die of hunger, dies of hunger. He is fated to be taken into servitude. Or befrata yitzya machlal, and never mind the fact that the Egyptians never prevented us from worshiping God, which is not I can't say the same about the Christians. What you hear in his words, and this pops up in a number of different places, what you hear in Abravanel is something that none of us, I think, have experienced in our lives, but which is very, very typical and very, very poignant for Jews for 2,000 years. There is a fundamental disconnect. There is a fundamental difficulty for a Jew to celebrate Pesach in consideration of the circumstances that he found himself through the course of the exile. Because on Pesach, what are we doing? We're celebrating our freedom, we're celebrating our liberation, we're celebrating, we're leaving to get the Torah, and then we're going to conquer Eretz Israel, and we're going to be independent. And Jews continue to experience that, and that we're bidden to experience that, when the world on the outside is far from friendly. Even, I mean, in good times for most of the period of the exile, if it was quiet, that was a mazel. But the problem is that there wasn't always quiet, especially in Christendom, because Pesach always comes together with Easter, because the original Easter was right after Pesach, right? What's the word for Easter in Hebrew? Pascha. And that word, by the way, and that's why the word for Easter in French and in Italian, the name, there are people whose name, they were Italians named Pasquale, means Easter. It all comes from Pesach. The two came together. So it was Dafka when Jews were celebrating our birth and our redemption, that we had to be afraid of pogroms, of blood libels, because that was just around that time that all the Christians were preoccupied with the story of the death of Jesus. And guess who they think did it, right? So during so-called Holy Week, for example, in many, many places throughout Europe, Jews were not allowed to be out of the house. Now, as it happens, that's probably a good thing, because they would be attacked on the street. And the paranoia on Pesach, okay, and talk about sort of disconnect. The paranoia was to such a degree that from the early High Middle Ages on, there is a sort of a footnote that gets listed in all, if not all, certainly most Ashkenazic Haggadahs and halachic discussions, that whereas the halacha prefers the use of red wine for ritual purposes, because it has more, you know, I'm going to sound like I'm a Feinschmecker, but it has more body and it has more taste and this and this and this, and it looks nicer and so on. If there's always this caveat, if there will be a problem, if there is any kind of danger that of a blood libel that they'll accuse the Jews of drinking Christian blood, use white wine. Can you imagine trying to make a Seder like that? In that kind of circumstance? Now, it wasn't always, but it was always out there. And this created a cognitive dissonance of, how do I celebrate the Seder? That takes tremendous, first of all, it takes a tremendous ability to compartmentalize, but also takes tremendous strength to keep going. And there were siddurim that were done in the ghettos. There were siddurim done in the camp, in World War II in the camps. The ability of the Jew to transcend his present circumstance and get past that, it's amazing. It's amazing. But I think we would appreciate what it takes to make a Seder if we realize what our brethren at other times and other places had to go through and had to, what kind of resources that they need to come up with to be able to pull this off. I think it'll only cause us to appreciate more that which we are doing. Interestingly, Abravanel was a man of tremendous faith. He was a rationalist, but he was a man of tremendous faith. Later on in his commentary, there's no time to read it now, but later on in his commentary, he notes that, you know what? The author of King David in the Book of Psalms says that I will remember when the final redemption comes. I will remember just how little faith and how much doubt I had. Well, we'll talk about doubt in the Mishnah, right? How much doubt I had. Even he realized that that the Jews would get through that. So that's just one example of the kind of, if you look at the way the commentary is right, you can not just get ideas that are eternal, but also get an idea of the experience of our ancestors. A wonderful way to do this is to also look at the pictures. I'll give you an easy example. From a collection. I hope you can be able to see this. From a collection that was put together actually in the early part of the 20th century by a rabbi who lived in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, whose name was Yehuda David Eisenstein. Eisenstein was a polymath. He wrote his own encyclopedia. And he put out a series of books called Great Collections, Otsarot, of all kinds of things. So when it comes to, I'm going to show you this. Here you have, can you see? Hold on, I'm trying to figure out how to do this, right? Nope. Oh, here we go. Okay, I hope you can see this. These are the four sons. You see, there's a rabbi, there's a boxer, there's a shy kid, and there's a little kid. Okay. Now, one of the people you should look out for in the Haggadah is the wicked son, because the wicked son changes his identity throughout the Haggadahs over the centuries. For many, many, many generations, they always portray the Russia, the wicked son, so-called, as a soldier. Because in order to be able to be a soldier, from the time that Bar Kokhba was defeated until the establishment of the various Jewish self-defense organizations in the late 19th century, before the Haganah even, before Jabotinsky organized the Haganah in 1920, 1921, the only way you could be a soldier is to convert to Christianity. And if you're a soldier and you're at the Seder, you are there to try to convince your relatives also to convert. In other words, to betray your people. So that was the Jewish mother's nightmare. And what does the wicked one's son say? He says, "What's this to you? You should come get with the program." So, and consistently, the wicked son is a soldier until you get to the 19th century. Once the 19th century comes, you have all kinds of different possibilities, because the Jewish mother's nightmare changed with time. And I invite you to take a look at your Haggadot and see who the illuminator was and what was involved. So the picture I just showed you is the Russia is a boxer. Oops, what's wrong with a boxer? Well, in the Lower East Side in the early 20s, of the 20th century, there were those Jewish kids who, you know, straight and narrow, they were going to make it in America by going to school, and they're going to be lawyers and doctors and, you know, whatever it is, and accountants and so on. But there were always those who were going to say, no, I'm going to be an American. I'm going to make it not that way. So you had, for example, you had Jewish organized crime. Okay. And you had those who decided to do things which were absolutely considered to be totally not Jewish. And one of them is boxing. Who boxes? Italians box. Chinese box. Irishman box. Nice Jewish boys don't box. So the Russia is the non-Jewish boy. There's the non-Jewish boy. Also, these are Jews who say Jews are weaklings, and they and you know. And in fact, if you look at the picture, you see that it looks as if it's organized. The boxer wants to give the chacham, who's always, so it looks like a sort of modern Orthodox rabbi with a hat, give him a snooker right in the nose. And you have others like that. They're in the major shit. And there's a Shik Haggadah that was done in the 1930s, in which the Russia is an assimilated Polish bourgeois citizen. There are all kinds. Now it's interesting how this can flip aside. You can also find values in or shifts in values. By the way, the Hartman Haggadah, which is called Vehigadat Lebincha, also has a collection of a lot of these representations of the four sons. It's actually a very good Haggadah. One of the more interesting shifts that you have, and you can watch this in Haggadah too, is even up to the 20th century in some Haggadahs, the bad guy, the bad son, the wicked son, is a soldier. From the 1940s on, the wise son is a soldier, especially Israeli ones. They were Haggadahs that were sort of improvised by the soldiers in the Jewish brigade that were in the British Army and went to try to liberate, to beat the Nazis and liberate the Jews of Europe. And there, the soldier is lionized because that's changed, right? So in other words, in a very real sense, the illuminations, and this is true of all kinds of other issues as well, the illuminations on the Haggadah are as much of an opening of a window into the soul of the Jews who produce them, as are the commentaries. So these are the two. So which means that you really, I know everybody who is cooking and cleaning and so on and so forth. Nevertheless, as Rav Soloveitchik always pointed out, every holiday requires preparation, and not just physical preparation, which is what most of us are doing, but also spiritual preparation. And that means pick your Haggadot, go buy a new Haggadah. I'm sure the Roy Sachs' Haggadah is similar to this in terms of being a contemporary reflection. By the way, one of the books that it seems to be a bestseller is this book, The Telling, by a guy named Mark Gerson, which has essays on the Haggadah. And from what I've seen of it, my impression is that it's a very American, universal, not too parochial, and I'm not so sure how Zionist a book it is, and maybe that reflects, what the Seder is for people in other places. The fact that you can take the Seder, which is again the most parochial, narrow national, there's nothing that non-Jews weren't invited to participate in the Seder, because it's really sort of like just for the family, as opposed to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, which are universalist holidays, and we have both. Turning the Pesach into something which you celebrate at the White House, I wonder myself what that means in terms of the people who participate and where that, what meaning they bring to that. So that's also could be a snapshot of where our parts of the present generation is. In any event, there's your homework. To take Haggadahs, prepare, and try to be probing. Having if you have little kids at the Seder, pictures are really good. They're good to engage them, because they say, what do you see? It's like a Rorschach test. And you'll be surprised what little kids might come up with if you show them pictures from illuminated Haggadahs. One last note, which has nothing to do with the Haggadah, but it's everything to do with this Pesach. A number of people have asked me, and I certainly am not co-opting Rabbi Constantine's right to decide halacha, but they're asking me what I'm doing in terms of the Shabbat meals. The truth is that in all candor, Rabbi Soloveitchik used to, when this happened a couple of times in the 70s, that Shabbat was Erev Pesach, and you have to get rid of the chametz. What are you going to do? He really was quite emphatic that people should use challah, because it's still Shabbos, it's not nice. His father, on the other hand, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, said that, based on a long series of considerations that I don't have really time right now, said that it is perfectly possible, in fact, it might be preferable, to use what Americans call egg matzah. Now, egg matzah is not matzah shirah. Matzah shirah in Israel, for example, are cookies, and Ashkenazim don't eat them, because Ashkenazim like to leave things out. But what I'm talking about egg matzahs, things that have the look of matzahs, but they're not made with water. They're made, in this case, with apple juice. They are not chametz. Ashkenazim don't eat them once we stop eating chametz as sort of a stricture, as a chumrah. We've talked about chumras in this year. But usually you can't use them for bread. You know, you say barim is a menem is a not. However, if you use them on Shabbat for lechem mishnah, you could actually say hamotzi lechem na aretz. And this way, you can have your meal, and you can not worry about having chametz in the house. You can be totally Pesach thick beforehand, and not worry what's going to be with the crumbs, and then what happens if one of the grandchildren, one of the children, grabs a piece of the challah. Maybe they'll go run away with it, because little kids have the status of mice in halachat, that they go and hide pieces of bread in it, wherever they're going to go. It's a no worry situation. You don't have to destroy it. You don't have to destroy it after 10 o'clock or whenever the time is. And you don't have to run your meal right away at 10 o'clock, because you're having you should be having a Pesach thick meal. When the time comes, you say the bitul, you say the nullification of the chametz, but beyond that, you don't have to do anything else. You continue eating, whatever the case might be. And if you have minors, you can give them the rest of the egg matzah. You adults can't, shouldn't eat it. But I think that's the best way to do it. That is what I'm doing. And that having been said, I wish everybody a happy and a healthy chag. Enjoy the Seder. What do we say here in Israel? Al tiyu b'stress. Don't be stressed out. Enjoy. And we, Yirmetz Hashem, will meet again on the first day of Chol HaMoed. And at that point, I think we will go back to Pirkei Avot. So, Chag Kasher v'Sameach, healthy, and enjoy.